I'd like to bring into to order the interim, still is the interim, isn't it?
Yes.
Interim House Committee on the General Government Consumer Protection. And do we need to do anything else? First on our agenda is a public hearing on LC 221. So with that, I'd like to open that public hearing. Jan, could you give us a summary of the LC at hand?
LC 221, and this is dated January 10th, 2012. It was drafted at the request of the co-chairs, and it addresses the regulation of pre-need funeral goods and services. And the committee had a hearing during the interim on this issue in September, and since then a work group met to address areas of concern. In general, LC 221 allows DCBS to regulate those who administer pre-need contracts, not just those who are selling or offering the contracts. And it gives greater discretion to DCBS in setting fees, and it caps the Consumer Protection Trust Fund at $2 million. Clarifies who can name a successor certified provider under various circumstances, and it clarifies which expenses may be paid out of earnings of the trust fund deposits. It declares an emergency effective on passage.
Thank you. So I'd like to welcome all in attendance. It's good to see some familiar faces, and yeah. Nice to have some new ones here as well.
Right in the middle of the
ball. First up to testify on this LC 221, we're going to have David Tapman, the administrator for DCBS. And I don't know if you intended to bring up some sort of staff support with you or not, but you're welcome to if you want.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Ms. Nordland, my name is David Tapman. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and I believe you received a version of my written testimony electronically already, so that you should have that. If you don't, we have a few extra copies. As requested, I'm here today to discuss and provide my support for LC 221, which I understand is a committee bill for this committee. It addresses issues around what we call the pre-need industry or funeral care matters. And this is something that I think is an important consumer protection issue, and it's something that we've raised before with this body and had an extensive amount of conversation with stakeholders. And I know you're aware of that there's stakeholders from both the industry and from various consumer protection groups behind me that will be also testifying about this, so I won't jump into their testimony. Let me just say, this is an important tool. You may remember down in Albany a couple of years ago, because I've reported this committee, there was a cemetery by the name of Twin Oaks, and the one-time owners of Twin Oaks engaged in what was known as selling pre-need contracts. Now, a pre-need contract is a contract that provides for funeral services, cemetery services, death-related needs, but it is pre-sold. It is sold prior to the time of need, so hence pre-need. And the pre-need contracts are usually designed to have the money paid either in full at the time the contract's entered into, or it can be paid over the course of the life of the contract, often in large chunks. The law does a good job of protecting the money by requiring it be put into some kind of a trust situation. So either a trust held by a bank or a trust administered by what is known as a master trustee. And I'll talk about that in a few minutes. Where the law has had some failings was, and this was what happened in the Twin Oaks situation, a certified provider, those that are selling the services in advance, has to be the one that gets the money delivered to this trust, either the bank trust or the master trustee. If the money's not delivered, such was the case there, that money can go awry and be misused. In that case, this couple took the money. It was over $400,000 and affected over 300 Oregonians. That money ended up being spent on real estate, their home, a number of cars, other personal effects and expenses. Because of the nature of pre-need activity, many times, many years will pass. I think the industry will tell you that the average is somewhere, I believe, between 8 and 12 years from the time a contract's entered into till the time it's needed. But you can imagine in a number of instances that could go well beyond and could be up to 15 and 20 years. That means that the discovery of misuse of the funds is problematic at best. That's why we think it is so critically important for this division, to our agency, I should say, to be engaged in robust oversight. And this is what the bill will help us do, is provide that type of oversight, whether it's through examination or through the filing of reports to us, or to ensure that people are qualified that are engaged in the pre-need activity of being a certified provider. As a side note, and something we'll get into in a few minutes, is there is a consumer protection fund. It's called the Consumer Protection Trust Fund, but I don't want to confuse trust and trust. So we'll just call it Consumer Protection Fund. That's a fund that the state administers. It's somewhat like the same thing that the insurance division uses with their insurance companies. It's to protect against some kind of problem like this defalcation. And that fund is funded at $5 on every contract that's sold that goes into the fund to provide for circumstances if a certified provider goes bankrupt or if a certified provider engages in criminal behavior like fraud that I've described. Now, that fund at one time reached $1.1 million, a substantial amount of money. However, a fraud of the nature of the Twin Oaks doesn't take very long to take that fund down quickly. Over the last year, we've paid out of $250,000 out of that fund, so it is down now to around $800,000. That fund is sufficient right now to cover our concerns or should the needs arise. However, if we were to have another, and these are always quick strike situations, it's not something where we only have to pay off one person at a time. Should we have another large problem of that magnitude, that fund could be wiped out. A couple years ago, we had another circumstance out of Eugene where there was a cemetery that purchased holdings from another organization. The claim was that organization had not properly trusted the monies that they had received, to the tune of over $1 million. Well, fortunately, that was worked out internally between the two companies. However, if it had come down to where we had to stand and provide, that would have been wiping out the entire fund. So that's a critical piece of that consumer protection. And as I say, I'll touch on that in a moment as a bullet point. Just a little bit of background procedurally. We introduced the bill in 2011 through this committee, and the bill was tabled through the 2011 session. But I think now the time is probably more ripe to bring this thing forward through Chair Holvey's efforts. A working group was brought together, as Ms. Nordland said, in November. There was a lot of discussion, revisiting language, and revisions to what we had proposed in 2011. I think the bill's better, it's cleaner, it's more straightforward. It also allowed us to have an opportunity to have dialogue with our stakeholders to try and fix some problems, not necessarily in the bill, but could be an impediment through the passage of the bill. I'm happy to report that we have arrived at a place where I think we can meet the needs of both the industry and the protection of the consumers. So we're in a good space in terms of what this bill proposes to do. Let me go through some of the high points. This shouldn't take very long, but I think it's important that you understand what the bill does. First and foremost, is, as you're probably more aware than I am, whenever the Legislative Council gets a hold of existing statutes to make amendments to them or deletions, this is our opportunity to clean it up. And LC, the Legislative Council, has taken this opportunity. And so that's why this is a 23-page bill. It's not that there are 23 pages of changes. It's mostly language changes. The changes, in fact, are fairly short and very specific. There are three things we try and do around certified providers. One, we want to make sure that everyone that's a certified provider is licensed with us and is subject to our full oversight. Right now, not all certified providers are under our direct control, because if they've chosen to stop selling because there are other options, they can sell insurance products rather than a pre-need product. If they've chosen to stop selling, we don't have full jurisdiction in that case, and we have concerns that they're still able to administer those funds. And so we want them to be under the same purview as all the hundreds of people who are certified providers are under our control. So that is a change, if you will, definitionally, and the industry supports that, and we believe that's a good thing, both for the industry and protect consumers. Also, we have situations where companies go out of business, whether voluntarily or involuntarily. We're concerned that in some instances, and we had this happen last year, the company going out of business will identify the successor. And the successor may not be qualified and may not even be licensed with us. But the transaction takes place, and all of a sudden we've got an unqualified or unacceptable person who's holding access to these funds. We think it's important in cases where, not all cases, but in cases where there's been problems, or more likely where there's been situations of bankruptcy or businesses being improperly run, that we have some say in the process of who is selected to be the follow-on company, the successor certified provider. Again, the industry supports that. I think it protects bringing in people who aren't qualified to do things that need a fair degree of sophistication to oversee the use of those funds. The industry asked us to consider the definition of guaranteed. A guaranteed pre-need contract means just what it sounds like. If you pay for the entire amount that was agreed to contractually, then you're entitled to receive those services at no further cost. So if somebody buys something in 2011 and passes away at 2025, but is paid in full, that means that price is your full freight for whatever services you're going to receive. That's the whole idea behind this. The industry wanted to make clear, though, and I think this is correct, that if somebody is going to rely on that guarantee, they have to pay in full. If they haven't made all the payments, then it's not fair that they get the same benefit as somebody who has made all the payments. So the bill identifies that guaranteed means it's a situation I've just described. And then lastly, just to clarify the use of the fees that are generated by the funds, the law allows up to 2% of earnings off of the fees on the money from that's been deposited in the trust fund to be made available to the master trustee, one of those seven entities in the state who will administer trusted funds. That 2% is right now somewhat ambiguous. It just says other fees as may be necessary. We believe some clarification would be useful there, and so the law proposes to identify the types of fees that may be made available to master trustees, and that includes accounting fees, taxes, depository fees, investment manager fees, and the fees that the master trustee has to exercise as well. Again, there's a cap on that. It can't exceed 2%, and as we understand from the industry, none of them have ever even taken the full 2% out. So we think that's a very reasonable approach.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Mr. Talman, would you please tell me where that is, what you're talking about now in the bill?
Mr. Co-Chair, when you say that, you're referring to
the fee, the additional fee. We're in the.
It's on page 17 of the draft. There's the 2%.
But then he said it can be another fee, that's that other fee, but there's no limit on that fee. You're done. Mr. Co-Chair.
Some wisdom.
You said there was another fee in addition to 2% that could.
No, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair. If I said that, I misspoke. What this proposal addresses is they get to take out that 2%. What we're doing is trying to clarify how it can and can't be used. That's all it is. It's definitional.
And
it's clarification. All it is. We're not adding any additional fees, Representative Wisnet. It's just a matter of saying what the fees they get now can be used towards.
Thank you.
A couple other requests that have made their way into the bill, one that we think is useful. Historically, the law now says we can determine how much is in trust once a year, at the start of the year. Industry feels that there are times where they may have a large swing. Maybe there's a movement afoot to promote these activities, or maybe that just through good sales practices see a large increase. They're not able to use that increase if it isn't in there on January 1st. What we proposed and the industry agrees with is it will twice a year take a snapshot and see what the fund balances are to determine the right fee, and then we'll come up with a formula that will take those two snapshots and then determine what the 2% would be for the industry. The industry's asked for this. We think that's a reasonable approach, and we don't think that causes any significant harm. Obviously, conversely, if the fees were to go down significantly, then they'd have less under management. So it's a push-pull situation, and we don't see that there's any fallout from that. The last thing that we have got in there that we want to propose, two last things, I'm sorry. The last thing around consumer protection is that we've asked for some clarification about what anti-fraud activities constitute violations. There wasn't any definition of that. Almost every program we regulate as regulators has an anti-fraud provision. It says you can't lie, steal, or cheat your clients. So we all would assume that's good, but it's nice to have it spelled out so that the industry has some sense of where we're coming from, and we can use that to define what practices are and aren't fair. It also it puts us consistent with a lot of other regulatory programs, which I think is a good thing to do. As I mentioned, we are also seeking to address the question of around the Consumer Protection Fund. As I've said, it's gone down. It's sufficient now. We would like to have the ability, and it's in the bill, or it speaks to it in the bill, to be able to increase the fund up to a reasonable size should it ever diminish below where we think it's sufficient. We've agreed that we'll have a cap on that. It can never exceed $2 million. That's a statutory cap. It would go through a rulemaking process. We would have all the same industry participants and consumer protection representatives to attend at an administrative hearing and arrive at where we think the appropriate size of that fund should be. But it would allow us to grow that fund up to make sure it provides the protections it was designed to do. There are a number of other issues that we've talked about in the past regarding our relationship with what I call the death care industry and with the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board, the OMCB. That's a separate governmental agency. They have their own responsibilities. They're the ones that licenses the people that engage in the cemetery practices and the mortuary practices. Interestingly enough, while those two are very separate functions from us, they retain authority over the salespeople that make the certified provider sales, and we retain the authority over the certified providers. It's part of the confusion, if you will, that's involved with the dual regulation. We think that's something that someday should be visited, but I understand in this short session, I think we've bit off enough right now, and I stand by the testimony I've given, and I'm happy to answer any questions, and again, urge your support for this concept.
Appreciate your testimony, and not seeing any further questions. I don't know if you want to mention anything about any future discussions going towards next session or any sort of rulemaking in the future.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. As a part of working with the various stakeholders, particularly the master trustees, we've agreed that what we want to do is clarify that in the rare instance where a master trustee actually suffers a financial loss because the holdings, the invested holdings did not have a sufficient return to cover their overhead, that as part of reasonable fees, they're entitled within that 2% block, but within that 2% block, they're entitled to set some money aside, subject to a cap, to be determined by rule, to cover future arrearages should there be a reversal. We're only aware of one company, one time, having a reversal, but we're also aware that the economic climate is fairly dicey right now, and so we think that's a prudent thing to do, and we'd like to put that in there.
Thank you.
And so that should come down after the February session, we believe.
Paul, I wanted to clarify.
Thank you. Representative Wisnant.
Thank you. Mr. Talman, so let me understand this. You're asking in the bill now that you're going to set the fee increases, not the legislature.
Representative Holby, Representative Wisnett, we are asking for authority to set the fees. That's correct, subject to the 333 provision, just like we have
the $2 million. Is that what's...
Representative Holby, Representative Wisnett, for the purposes of the Consumer Protection Fund, it could go up to $2 million, but we are not asking for the authority just to willy-nilly raise that. We're saying that that would be subject to situations where that we believe the fund is so reduced that it fails to provide what's necessary. That's subject to the administrative hearings process and fact-finding and input from all the stakeholders. That's not a unilateral decision, if you will. That's a joint rulemaking decision.
Okay. Final question, please.
Go ahead.
So we're up. We went as high as $1.1 million in the fund. We've never approached the two. We've never gotten to the $2
million. Correct.
But we're now $800,000. And
correct.
That took care of the Eugene problem. In Eugene, we had to bail them out on that, the consumers out in that situation.
Was it Eugene?
Albany. Was it Albany?
Yes. Representative Wisnett, that's correct.
And there's been no other cases in Oregon?
There have been other cases. There have been other cases previously, and we have paid out in the past. But that's been quite a while, and it went up to $1.1 million. Again, we don't anticipate going up to the $2 million. The $2 million is a cap just that would reflect if the size of the holdings was that large. At this point, the amount of dollars held in trust wouldn't warrant a $2 million.
And did the state sweep some of that funding in the past? They took the interest or something out of the fund?
Chair Holby, Chair Wisnett, I'm not aware of any funds getting swept out. If it was swept out, it would have been swept out by the legislature at the time it went from Secretary of State to our agency. I'm not aware of that. I've heard people say that, but we've gone back and we can't find any difference between what was at the Secretary of State at the time it was transferred to us and when we took over. It's just the use of the funds go up and down. There was a perception that it was way up there, but we can't find it ever exceeded that $1.1 million.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate you running through this again. I know it seems redundant to you, but it's good to refresh our memories.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Next up, I'd like Wally Ordeman and John Brenneman. Good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you.
Gentlemen.
Thank
if you. You'd state your name for the record before you
Chair
start,
Holby
that'd be great.
And, Chair Wisnett, members of the committee, my name is John Brenneman. I've represented the funeral directors for a number of years as their lobbyist. I represent the Oregon Funeral Director Association. I do not represent the funeral trust. The funeral trust is run by the organization. We have cross membership. A number of our members of OFDA are members of that trust board. They run that. And but in the course of the negotiation on this bill, we really, the Funeral Directors Association, really do appreciate the fact that Mr. Tapman and Ms. Hackett sat with us and took care of our concern that was spoke to by Mr. Tapman just a moment ago, and in their commitment to do a rulemaking process that could create a reserve fund. There was that 1 year that we ran short and ended up having to borrow some money from the Oregon Funeral Directors Association to make that. The money is invested in very conservative pieces of equipment of bonds and so forth that don't produce a lot of income. With me, as you know, is Wally Ordeman, who's the legislative chair for the Oregon Funeral Directors Association. As such, he also met with DCBS in that negotiation with Chair Holby last week, and will speak to the association's support.
Thank you, Chair Holby, Chair Wisnett, and members of the committee. I am Wally Ordeman, and for the record, my name is Wally Ordeman, and I am coincidentally from Albany, a funeral director, and chair of the Oregon Funeral Directors Association Legislative Committee. The OFDA is very grateful for the opportunity to participate in the process that brought about this legislation. We do feel like our voice has been heard and do support the passage of LC 221. We're also grateful to Mr. Tapman, Ms. Hackett, Mr. McCord for their willingness with DCBS to initiate administrative rulemaking to tighten up some things such as the creation of reserve accounts to pay help with fees during down years. OFDA and DCBS share the same goal of consumer protection with the regulation of pre-need trusts. Part of that protection, OFDA believes, is keeping trusts viable. And over-regulation of trusts and the regulation becoming burdensome to funeral homes could create a situation where funeral homes decide to stop offering trusts, which we don't feel is in the best interest of Oregonians. I don't feel that this legislation crosses that line, and we are supportive of LC 221 and of its passage.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Questions? Okay. You're letting you guys off easy this time.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Next up, Chad Dresselhaus and Ty Cochran. Welcome, gentlemen. You'd state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Chair Holby, Chair Wisnett, my name is Ty Cochran. I'm with the Cemetery Association of Oregon. This bill essentially cleans up the definition of a certified provider and depositories, and it clarifies the meaning of guaranteed and non-guaranteed contracts. It also separates the endowment care portion out of the trusting and the exemptions thereof, and it places it back in an area where it's much easier to understand. It clarifies and enforces the DCBS's position when a certified provider were to change hands or simply get into trouble, and it also helps them simply do their job, and it sets up a reasonable emergency fund, as Mr. Cavanaugh mentioned. I think that they've went over a lot of things I've already covered, so I'll spare you on that again. But I would like to thank the DCBS for their diligent effort in working with all the parties concerned and making these changes that most certainly will protect the consumers of Oregon. And I'm happy to answer any questions you have about the bill.
Thank you. Not seeing you. Go ahead.
Co-chairs Holvey and Wisnett and members of the committee, my name is Chad Dresselhaus, and I'm with American Funeral and Cemetery Trust Services. We are a registered master trustee in the state of Oregon. I want to thank you for allowing me the opportunity to provide testimony relating to LC 221. We're in favor of LC 221 moving forward. We believe that it includes clarifications and additions that would be beneficial to the public, industry members, and DCBS. We are pleased that LC 221 allows for vendors to appropriately be compensated for the services they provide during the year by altering the calculation from once a year to at least once every 6 months. We are particularly looking forward to participating in the rulemaking process to determine how this calculation will work. LC 221 also provides DCBS with the means to continue operating effectively by allowing it to maintain a reasonable emergency fund balance and revising master trustee and certified provider fees based upon need. We are supportive of these fee increases with the understanding that any proposal would go through the rulemaking process prior to implementation, and that any increase would be necessary for DCBS to continue being viable and effective. We value the relationship we have with DCBS and appreciate the time and effort everyone has contributed to the drafting of LC 221. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your participation in this process and all that you've done to help get us to where we are. And any questions of these gentlemen? Representative Wisnett.
Real quick, we passed a bill this session that about rate increases that agencies create. They have the authority. This has given the agency authority, but I think that those increases still, I think according to that bill, we had to still come back to the legislature. Is this different because we're putting it in the statute that they can do it without? We passed a bill that said if you, after we adjourn, if the agency raises a fee, that they have to come back to the next session, whatever session that is, short session or long session, to get an approval. So this is taking that out of that with the statute. Is that how you read that, Mr. Dresler-Haas?
Well, Co-Chair Wisnant, I am aware that recently I think there was a proposed increased fee for the master trustee and certified provider, and that was readjusted by the legislature, I believe.
Yeah, we can
but I'm not sure about the future fees,
thank
the
you.
Increases.
Thank you. Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony, gentlemen. Next up, I have Andrea Ogston and Rick Bennett, and we'll have our committee administrator follow up with your question and get some clarification on that. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Holby and Wisnant, members of the committee, on behalf of Legal Aid Services, I'd like to offer...
if you could state your name for the record, please.
Sorry, Andrea Ogston. And I am giving testimony today in support of LC 221. I previously testified, and pardon me if it's a little bit redundant, but just to refresh your memory, Legal Aid provides free legal services for low-income Oregonians and elders. And I focus on senior law cases. So this bill intersects with our population, or the people we serve, in that when seniors are looking at going into a nursing home or an assisted living facility, they're able to purchase a prepaid funeral plan or a pre-need plan without losing their eligibility for Medicaid. So typically, this planning is happening on a very short timeline. Sometimes a senior will have as short of 1 week to locate a provider, purchase the plan. And so, as you can imagine, this is a very stressful time for the family. They can be vulnerable because of this semi-crisis moment where they're looking at leaving their home and relocating. We support the bill because it allows additional oversight. It provides a fund for people to go to if they are defrauded. I think that the oversight happening on the front end is particularly helpful because oftentimes the person that negotiated this contract is deceased at the time it's implemented. So I think sending a clear message to potential bad actors that they are being regulated is helpful because, as a practical matter, these cases don't frequently come back unless you have cases where it's a husband and wife who've purchased a plan together. I believe that the vast majority of these businesses are very professional and act with great integrity. I've had very good experiences with them, but in instances where there are bad actors, it's very helpful to have that fund in place and to have the clear definition of what constitutes fraud. Thanks.
Chair Holby, Chair Wisnant, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. I participated in the discussions of the work group and really appreciated the different views that were shared and the work done to find consensus on the issues that are before you in LC 221. We support the concept and we'll support the legislation when you consider it in February. The only other comment I would make is related to the Consumer Protection Fund and, of course, the issue of being able to increase the current $5 fee if circumstances warranted that. And And frankly, from our point of view, we think that is a good consumer protection, having that ability to do so. Clearly, it's done within the rulemaking process with participating in input from all parties concerned. And I think the consensus or compromise there for having the ability to do that is, in fact, having some type of cap on the fund itself. And we believe that a $2 million cap is a very reasonable amount to do so. So with that, we support the effort here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate you paying attention to the issue and for your participation in this as well. Questions of this panel? Not seeing any. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your time.
And it probably will be the intent of this committee to have a short public hearing on this LC. It's not written in stone yet, but on the first day of session. Given that, we're hoping that this testimony will be able to be used for the record on that LC, though we may end up asking you to resubmit your letters with the bill number on it once we get the bill number. So appreciate your indulgence on that, and please stay in touch with our committee administrator on that particular issue. She'll probably contact you if we need anything else from you individually on that. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on LC 221. So let's open up a public hearing on LC 257.
The summary. Yeah, you had me down as the summary.
Oh, yeah. Do you want me to give the summary on that?
LC 257, summary, please.
You said I was going to do it.
Oh, I thought you were asking me to.
No,
please go ahead. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Cusp.
Representative Wisnett, you can be the administrator for introducing this concept.
Yeah. This idea I picked up in the SEIU Move Oregon Forward publication, where they had several recommendations for the legislature to consider. And this recommendation was that small agencies might want to use the Department of Administrative Services Shared Client Services Units for payroll, accounting, budget development, procurement, rather than continue the costly and duplicated practice of keeping these practices in-house. Their analysis was that we could save as much as $2 million a year if all 45 such agencies use the shared client services. So that got my attention, and with Co-Chair Hovey's support, we agreed to submit this as a committee bill. Last session, we looked at another recommendation was House Bill 2020 that we moved forward out of this committee that addressed how many people a supervisor should supervise, looking at something like a 1-14 ratio at the lower level. The higher you go up in a bureaucracy, the less number you'll be supervising. So this is what we brought forth the bill. We changed for the Moving Oregon Forward document. Talked about looking and studying it. We said let's go further than that. So this bill says you will implement it unless you justify why you should not. And I guess we're going to hear some testimony maybe why we should not. So we'll see.
Thank you. I'd like to have Joy Sebastian and Robert Sisk come forward for testimony on that. And do you have anything to add, Jan?
I do not. Thank you.
I want to give you the opportunity.
Supervise Holvier, isn't it? They need a one on one.
That's a fair point.
Good afternoon and welcome. And if you would state your name for the record and give us your thoughts.
Thank you. Co-Chair Holvey and Co-Chair Wisnett, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Joy Sebastian for the Department of with the Department of Administrative Services, the Acting State Controller. So I think you're being handed out some information on Legislative Concept 257, so I'll wait for that to finish. Good.
You can go ahead. They can get caught up.
All righty. I sure would. I'd like to direct your attention to the handout that's been provided for Legislative Concept 257. This concept requires agencies with 75 or fewer full-time equivalents use the Department of Administrative Services for budgeting, purchasing, accounting, financial reporting, and human services. There is, of course, a provision for an exemption from DAS. We included only accounting and human service functions because they were quantifiable. So I'm just going to go through and recap the last page. It's labeled Agency Supported by DAS. We segmented the seven legislative and judicial branches because we believe the intent was not to include these agencies. However, if our sense was wrong, then we'll be glad to incorporate this into further review. Out of the 39 remaining agencies, in summary, 13 are served by both DAS SCD, State Controllers Division, and HRSD. 14 are shared client services of SCD or HRSD. 5 are served by other agencies for both HRSD and SCD. And 7 do not receive accounting or human resource services. I'm going to now break this out by function, just as another look at it. Of the 39 non-legislative and judicial branch agencies, all agencies with fewer than 24 FTE are being served by the accounting function. 5 are being served through agencies other than Department of Administrative Services, and the remaining 25 are being served via State Controllers Division Shared Client Services. For the 9 agencies that are not serviced, we didn't indicate if the agency had an appropriate level accounting staff. Some have excellent accounting resources, and others are more challenged. Regarding the HR function, of the 39 non-legislative and judicial branch agencies, 15 are receiving services from HRSD. Of the remaining 24, 5 are serviced by other agencies, 3 have HR professionals, and the remaining 16 are using non-HR professionals to perform HR functions. In the case of both HR and accounting functions, there is help available in DAS. However, the assistance is not nearly as extensive as the assistance provided by those that are receiving shared financial and HR services. The non-shared client services assistance provided is answering questions rather than performing the work. I'd like to refer you to the bottom of page 1 and the top of page 2 for the specific shared services provided listed under SCD, State Controllers Division, and HRSD, Human Resource Services Division. Although we certainly recognize there is a risk in having functions performed by someone that may not be appropriately skilled, it is not clear how the $2 million savings was determined. We would be glad to investigate this further if that is the desire of this committee. Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnott, and members of the committee, this concludes my report, and I'm glad to entertain questions.
Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair, Cameron. Do we know who came up with the $2 million in savings? Are we going to hear from them?
Yes, next.
Okay, great.
Thank you. Go ahead and state your name.
Okay,
for the record,
Co-Chair Hobley, Co-Chair Wisnat, and other members of the committee. For the record, my name is Robert Sisk, and I'm an employee with the Department of Administrative Services, and I'm a member of SEIU 503 and president of DAS Local 125. I'm here to talk about how LC 257 would increase efficiency and cost savings in state government by allowing expansion of shared client services. As Joy said, the Department of Administrative Services provides a variety of administrative services to small agencies to help minimize staff through the Shared Client Services Program, SCS, which covers such areas as payroll, county budget development, and procurement. Participation in the SCS program allows small agencies to avoid diverting valuable staff time to administrative processes, thereby saving the agency money and maximizing the agency's ability to deliver core services. There are 45 small agencies defined as having 75 or fewer full-time equivalent or FTE positions eligible to use the SCS program. And here I'm going to, my numbers I hope will not be different from Joy's. They're going to be a little identified a little bit different, maybe a little bit more generic, but anyhow, they should be the same. These agencies have a choice of whether to use SCS, but not all agencies are taking advantage of this cost-effective program. Currently, 20 agencies participate in SCS, 12 licensing agencies, 6 governing agencies, and 2 hearing agencies. In addition to the 20 agencies served, the SCS program also provides support to the Office of the Governor. These are agencies ranging in size from 3 FTE to 75 FTE. This means that there are 25 additional small agencies that could be utilizing the SCS program. Agencies under 75 FTE would have to use SCS or document that they can provide the service for cheaper. Agencies should also be required to do an analysis on all services that can be used at DAS to see if there are additional potential cost savings. And I want to say right now, having interviewed some of the people in SCS, that I want to commend them on their good customer service ethic. And when we say that agencies should be required to do an analysis, I want to really underscore that there is a good customer service ethic and rapport with these agencies that they are now serving, and that would be the ideal for the future. They sit down and have a discussion with them. It's kind of like a good salesman, you know, how can we help you? How can we help you save money? How can we make your operation more efficient by providing our services? So it's not a heavy-handed thing. It's a very good relationship with the agency, and I think the objective is to come out on the end as to how that agency can be served to the best, but also get those efficiencies and those cost savings. So that's what's going on right now, and I commend them for that that customer service ethic. I think they get a lot of respect and appreciation from the agencies they're now serving. The 2011 legislature attached a note to the DAS budget requiring consideration of cost savings reduction through shared services for information technology. And I might at this time point to the state data center where we've already undergone this kind of shared services. And I think we've had one of the legislatures take a trip out there last session, was very impressed by the operation. So this is kind of an indicator of how that can work. Human resources, as Joy talked about, budgeting and technology. The note sets a goal of 10% savings in administrative functions and asks DAS to work with other state agencies to meet that goal. This was the first step in finding potential savings through centralization of administrative services, including looking at how small agencies can save money by fuller utilization of DAS shared client services. We would like to emphasize that any worker adversely impacted by moving services into the shared client service program should be transferred into jobs at DAS where their talents and expertise could be appreciated and used, and possibly over a period of time as vacancies occur. And I'm happy to answer any questions that I may be able to answer.
Questions? Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Thank you both for your testimony. And Mrs. Sebastian, so I guess the next step that on this bill is, would you, you know, does DAS feel it's worth pursuing? Does DAS feel that there's efficiencies and savings here that SCIU has talked about? Or do you feel that, you know, you've been doing it and it's at a maximum level of efficiency?
Co-Chair Holvey and Co-Chair Wisnott, we will be glad to pursue it if it's the desire of this committee. I don't know that we don't understand the savings. I don't understand the savings right now, so I would need to work with someone who generated the number and understand those savings.
Can I respond to something here?
Certainly, go ahead.
I think, Co-Chair Wisnett, one of the things you mentioned at the beginning was HB 2020, and I think that's one of the things we'd be looking at here, getting rid of the more of the managerial layers here and getting to the span of control. objectives of HB 2020, and that would be one of the big cost savings. So we're looking to perhaps get that implemented a little quicker so we can realize those savings, but that would come into play into this as well.
So to clarify, you're saying that you might be able to not need some sort of administrative level services that exist in the smaller agencies now by moving those services into DAS?
Exactly. And the way I understand this from talking to the people in the program, it's kind of like buying in bulk. You know, they can become more efficient by bundling things together.
But it does seem like it would increase the workload to DAS, and they'd probably have to, you know, have additional people to perform those services that are now being performed in the smaller agencies. So I think that's kind of puts into question how much savings there really is. We don't know, mm-hmm. but maybe it's something that the two of you can, you know, have a discussion about and figure out.
And let me say this, that we want to be good partners with DAS in bringing these savings about and providing any kind of information or involvement that we can to do that. I think that's really an interest of both of our parties, so that's what we'd like to do.
Sure.
I think it's a discussion worth having, for sure. Any other questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is probably a question for DAS, but looking at some of these smaller agencies that are below the 5 to 6 personnel, when you get below there, I've met with some of those. And they've told me for some of the administrative costs when they've come to you to help them or get assistance from you, they'll be hit with numbers like $40,000, and they'll go out and buy an accounting program and just do the accounting themselves and turn in the numbers to you. So have you ran into that where some of these have approached you and said, hey, what's it going to take to use your services? And they about get floored by the amount of money it would cost to do it through you guys out of their budget, so they go ahead and do it in-house?
Co-Chair Colvey and Co-Chair Wisnott, as well as members of the committee. If you look in the list for the accounting services, all of the small agencies are already using accounting services or that of the Public Utility Commission until we get up to 10. So perhaps that's more of a question for the HR services, and I would not be the person to answer that, but I'll be glad to get an answer back to you.
Thank you. Other questions?
Yeah.
Representative Smith.
Thanks. So in the follow-up information, what would be helpful is if we can glean anything from experiences that other places do, because it does seem like the question is whether there's scale economies or diseconomies of scale, and that's the question. And very often we have a bias towards thinking there's scale economies, but I know, for instance, in major computer projects, perhaps it's the opposite. You actually save money if you don't hire 60 consultants to build you something, but buy smaller things off the shelf. And so if we have either data from experience here or data from experience elsewhere, that'd be helpful in the follow-up materials.
Yes, sir.
All right. Appreciate your testimony. I don't see any other questions, and I'm sure someone will be talking to you. Hopefully you can talk to each other, and maybe Representative Wisnett or the committee administrator can follow up with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree completely. I'll probably talk to both of you, and what we may want to look at, especially as I'm looking at these lists, some of them are located in the same building, for one thing, in the Portland building, I think. We might want to look at if there's any efficiencies there and some of the bigger organizations there of doing that. So,
yes, sir. Be glad to do that.
We'll be glad to talk and get your input back and see if we need any chances of moving it forward with some efficiencies. And we're looking for a lot of efficiencies this budget or this session. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on LC 280. And according to my...
It's LC 257.
Oh, excuse me. I closed something before I was going to open it. Close the public hearing on LC 257 and open a public hearing on LC 280. And we'd like to have Representative Nancy Nathanson, Cindy Forrest, and Patricia Whitfield. Good. Good afternoon. If you'd like to introduce yourself for the record and give us your thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
On this LC.
And members of the committee. My name is Nancy Nathanson. I represent House District 13. I want to thank you for your courtesy in hearing my comments generally about what I perceive as a problem with criminal background checks or criminal record checks. We've spoken in the past in a more general fashion. I'm going to save your time. I'm not going to speak about that and repeat it in that perspective. In this LC, what I'm proposing is not the solution, but a path to a solution. What I suggest is that it's time to fix the problem now, and this LC instructs DAS to start the work that will result in the problem being in the situation being improved. So what I bring to you today are some specific examples of why I had become aware that this is so important and there are so many people, frankly, aggravated with the situation. An employer or volunteer working with school-aged children needs a criminal background check for the public school that is not transferable to a similar job, such as K-12 versus preschool, if the person chooses to also work in another school setting. Not transferable. Staff and volunteers at both the Pearl Buck Center and the Arc of Lane County in my area are required, but this is similar to situations in all of your districts. Staff at those organizations, they handle similar clients, they're just separate organizations, they're required to get a criminal background check from both the Child Care Division and DHS MRDD. People who provide respite for foster care providers in the DD system must have a criminal background check for each provider for whom they provide care because the check is not transferable across foster providers, again doing the same work. If a school employee, like a special ed assistant, works part-time for a school district and then does other part-time work for an educational service district, they have to have another criminal background check. Same person, same job, maybe even simultaneous if it's two part-time jobs. Classified employees, such as bus drivers, secretaries, janitors, are required to get background checks every time they move to another district. Since those jobs are subject to budget cuts, and some workers have to move jobs to another school or another district, and that is happening right now, as you can appreciate, the waiting time that's associated with getting that new background check to do the same job, just in another school, that's costing everybody time with clear economic impacts for that individual or the family, and sometimes impacts for the school that's trying to hire them. A teacher who wants to also serve as a speech pathologist or a school psychologist is required to have a separate license and therefore another criminal background check. In many cases, these are workers who can ill afford to have the cost of two or three or more background checks. Redundant criminal background checks are not only costly and inefficient, they cause hardship for the clients who are trying to retain the services. They're trying to hire someone to provide service for a child or a parent, for example, who needs care. For example, if a family gets a grant for respite services for their child with a disability, their chosen provider must have a criminal background check. Even if that same provider has already had a criminal background check for a different client the month before, they still have to go through the process again. But because there's such a backlog in processing criminal background checks, the respite grant might actually expire before the family is ever able to use the service. There's a story that I received just a few days ago. It's a current story. There's a woman who has been employed as a teacher in an early intervention program beginning in 2007. She underwent the background check, including FBI fingerprinting, since she had worked in a different state for the preceding 18 months. She was also registered with the Child Care Division Background Registry. She also, the same year, started providing child care to the children of a co-worker at her agency. One of those children happened to also be a student in her classroom. She has continued to provide child care since that time for that family for the last 4.5 years. The child is now in a regular public elementary school. This woman then enrolled in a master's degree program, very happy, has finished that program. Instead of just being a substitute, she continued to substitute teach in the original program. Her child care registry status was removed. She received her master's degree. That's all great news. Her teaching certificate, everything is still fine, right? However, in the fall, she applied to provide behavioral consultation services through Lane County DD to the very same child she was still providing child care to. She has to have another background check for what she's already been doing for 4.5 years and for the same child. I did hear from one provider that was appreciative that there have been some marked improvements in one of the DHS systems and is very happy about that. However, points out some other failings. None of those three systems accept each other's clearances. There are different administrative rules that drive the requirements, and the requirements are somewhat different. You would think that it would make sense to have different requirements, perhaps, for someone providing services for children versus adults or the disabled. You could understand how an agency might come up with some different administrative rules or requirements, but the requirements are different even for children, depending on which agency or which program it is. The fingerprinting issue it is interesting. Oregon Department of Education absolutely requires fingerprinting, but DHS, also interested in protecting children, allows fingerprinting only if certain initial disclosures occur. So it's a real different philosophy about whether to require fingerprinting or not. So in some cases, we're seeing that maybe we're overdoing what we should be doing. In other places, there's a potentially alarming gap in what we ought to be doing. And in the daycare registry, according to this one person who is an HR manager, fingerprinting is almost never requested. So what you see is pretty much a tangle in procedures. Individuals around this state are having to go through multiple background checks. Different departments have different rules, different requirements. It seems to me that people aren't talking to each other, much less designing a process or a system that will work together. This situation just begs for some sort of change. And what this this legislative council language does is it starts the work to get this addressed. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we'll go ahead and ask any questions of Representative Nathanson at this point. Any? Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nathanson, I am so glad you are taking this on. I've been involved with this issue for so long now. Thank you for working on it. How do you feel about that? Good luck. Good luck is what I will also say.
I'll do my darndest.
Thank you. So let's go ahead and hear from Cindy.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Hovey and Wisnet. For the record, I'm Cynthia Forrest. I'm here from DAS Human Resource Service Division. As drafted, this legislative concept requires the Department of Administrative Services to convene a work group to develop specific recommendations, which create a single system to be administered by the Oregon State Police for the purpose of checking criminal history checks on individuals who are licensed by the state. And it also requires DAS to report this to the Legislative Committee by November 30th of 2012. It might be helpful to talk just briefly about the history of criminal background checks. Approximately 46 or more agencies have authority to check the record, the criminal histories of either licensees or employees or both. And each of them were granted statutory authority by the legislature. And in 2005, if you remember, House Bill 2157, it granted approximately 36 agencies the authority to request the national and nationwide and state criminal records check from the police for non-criminal justice purposes, and then in 2005, three additional agencies also gained authority in separate bills. In 2007, House Bill 2255 granted authority to check seven more agencies so they could check records, and then in 2009 also addressed criminal records check. And also some of the approximately eight agencies have governor's executive orders in order to check backgrounds. Now, the authority to check a criminal history is generally paired with rule writing, and the rule writings sometimes specify what needs to occur through the statute, such as the precluding crimes for a specific job, time span that you would look back on how long the crime had been committed, the time span for records to review, hearings, appeal process, and also a disposal process for the records. Each agency is required to draft their own rules and have them reviewed by the appropriate stakeholder groups, such as Department of Justice or the Oregon State Police. Currently, DAS doesn't have a role in the state's ability to check the criminal background history checks. However, when 2157 was approved, because so many state agencies were involved in that, DAS worked hand-in-hand with the Oregon State Police and others and Department of Justice to provide training to the agencies on their rule writing process and what each of the elements of the bill meant. And that was DAS's extent of assisting the agencies in the process. After reviewing the concept, we appreciate the authority to name members in addition to the people and convene the work group under the expedited reporting time frame. The purpose of the work group is clearly stated. What we need, we would appreciate clarification on whether the intent of the bill is to address criminal history checks for licensees, or if it's to address it for employees of Oregon state government, or is it for both? It appears the concept currently only addresses licensees. As far as the fiscal goes, the DAS Human Resource Division has reviewed the concept, and there's a possibility of a fiscal impact. With greater understanding of the legislative intent, the impact could be narrowed. But at this time, the implementation could range from assembling a work group and providing some high-level recommendations in November, or the work group could spend an extensive amount of time considering various elements that would contribute to the system. And in either case, we're operating on the assumption that we'll need some assistance from both the Oregon and United States Department of Justice. In summary, we want to let you know we appreciate the opportunity to continue the discussions and help our partner agencies with the administration of their criminal records check, and clarification about the scope of the work group would be helpful as this conversation moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. And just FYI, we do have an amendment to clarify the licensing agency versus employee-employer issue that you raised.
Thank you, Chair Hilby.
Any questions? Seeing anything? And Patricia, I think you've talked to us about this before.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Tricia Whitfield, Oregon State Police Identification Services Section. And I wanted to thank you for the opportunity, but also share with you what our thoughts are and what our role might be in the work group. As the Central Repository for Oregon Criminal History Records, arrest records are what make up those criminal histories, obviously, but they've also expanded to non-criminal justice purposes and applicant background checks, such as the topic of this particular concept. So we would like to offer our assistance and our experts' experience in that particular area. We're also the service provider, though, for those agencies that were spoken about earlier. There are about 50 state agencies that have been given the authority and are currently using our system for background checks, and there are about 25 agencies that also have the authority that aren't utilizing that particular authority at this time. So I appreciate the fact that the concept includes a lot of folks to come to the table to speak to the experiences and find some additional efficiencies in the process. Would also hope that we could provide some information maybe an advisory capacity or as a liaison with the FBI, because we are also the connection for law enforcement and for non-criminal justice background checks to obtain federal level background checks and criminal histories. I would hope also that we could offer enough information and, again, share what our experiences have been in making sure that there's enough information at the table for all of the folks making the decisions to know that it is a complex discussion, and I think there have been some attempts to find some efficiencies. I know there are efficiencies in the process, but certainly sounds like there could be more. So we would want to make sure that we had the opportunity to share that information, what is currently available for folks, what isn't, what the law allows, some of the restrictions or limitations there. We know that it is not a simple fix. There are some things out there that the group will undoubtedly talk about that may look like a simple fix, but we want to make sure that the ramifications or any impacts are known of that. One size does not fit all, which adds to the complexity, but again, we would offer anything that we had to assist in the process. Some potential impacts that we would see possibly at OSP are, depending on what the intent and the clarity will help us as well, what our role ultimately will be. Depending on the resources, we would also look forward to any efficiencies either within the agency's processes or within the services that we provide. We'd want to also be cautious of the impacts of the efficiencies and how it affects ID services. And we have become a fee-based operation, and our fee structure has been changed from general fund to other fund, and a combination of both. So we want to make sure that those impacts are known and how they affect the rest of our operation. Currently, our fee-based programs, including the criminal background checks for these applicant processes, is a pivotal part of our core services that we refer to, the criminal history repository that we maintain for all users is definitely supported by that. So we just want to make sure that we get those thoughts on the table as well. And then always keeping a balance between sharing information, which we all think is a very good thing to do, and then also maintaining the confidentiality that we're required to do and that the laws in our state were intended to uphold. So those are just a few of the thoughts that we had regarding the concept. Our agency is neutral, but we're happy to help in any way we can. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Widener.
Just since
still not used to seeing you down there.
So it's because you missed me. So thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might be for the state police, might be for Representative Nathanson. I remember you bringing this forward last time, and it's a great idea. But I'm trying to get a grasp, and I've actually hit my wife up because I voted on a bill that got her laid off last time, but she has some specific skills that they rewrite stuff to put her in other spots because they don't want to lose her. But when she's came back on, she has not had to re-go through any of the testing. So even though she's been laid off, people would get bumped and she would move in the way things work in the process, and she didn't have to go through any criminal background checks again. So what would trigger, and that's even when she'd moved from a different department, I think she was able to use it last time too, that they didn't recheck her criminal background as well. But it does make me feel comfortable knowing that I'm safe sleeping with her at night because she has been checked several times on this. And she can't remember the number of times, but I think she's had like two background checks since she's worked for the ESD and in the school systems, because she's worked for different schools and the ESD probably the last 3 years, 4 years. So that's why I'm kind of curious to see what you've found for the testing and how many people are getting repeat tested, you know, over a three-year period?
Co-chairs, Representative Widener, I think that the agencies can best answer what their process is. Some are employment, some are licensing, some are certifications, and there might be a renewal process. State police doesn't determine when those are done, but at the present time, the majority of the background checks that we conduct that are fingerprint-based, we are required by law to destroy the fingerprints, and so it is that moment in time, and we can't conduct another check without another fingerprint submission. But again, it would be up to the agencies to determine how often and how many checks that they run. Fingerprint-based, that is.
So how quickly do you have to destroy those fingerprints? Immediately, or, I mean, do you, is there a shelf life to fingerprint records within the state police?
Co-Chair Holby, there were multiple sort of questions there. The statute requires that when we've completed the background check, we need to destroy the fingerprints. And for operational purposes, that isn't immediate. We typically bill the agencies. We want to make sure that they get the results back and we don't destroy them before something comes up and we might have to rerun that. But for all intents and purposes, we do destroy those immediately when that process is done. You indicated if there was a shelf life for fingerprints, and I don't know if that means, do they ever change? They certainly can change. Someone can be, have an amputation or something of that nature, but the fingerprints themselves don't change, just in case that was part of
it. I meant the records, not the fingerprints themselves. So, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Mrs. Whitfield, I apologize in advance that you've been here several times, and I appreciate all the information you've brought us. And thank Representative Nathanson. I mean, this is a big thing, trying to get your hands around it. Have you provided us previously a list of all the agencies that are in the bill, you know, what the statute required it, you know, so we have a picture of what, you know, Dash did a good job of talking about how many different bills we're the problem here. We passed all these, but we're trying to protect the public. But we've got such a big bureaucracy, and this thing is so big now. Do you have a list of all the agencies and what their what statute required it, what they're required? And there's different levels of background checks. Is that correct?
Coach Wizard, yes. In November, we provided a list of the state agencies. Happy to provide.
I'll get a copy of Representative Hovey's. I'm sure he's got his.
I wasn't here.
We gave you a copy. Maybe Jan can provide it. Does it also have the cost?
We do have that information. I don't know that it's on the exact document, but we have all the information, and it was provided in a packet. If it needs to be presented in a different way,
I may have it. I'm terrible. Best Representative Hovey, or Chair Hovey, follow up, please.
Follow up.
The my concern here is we want to protect the public. I agree with all that, but also, we've had a couple of hearings starting back in 2009 in this committee about the cost. Most of these are coming through you. What's the state spending for background checks? A year or biennium? And how big a staff do you have?
I believe that we provided detail in the package. I don't have that necessarily handy. I can certainly get that for you. But
I apologize in advance.
No problem. No apology needed. We do have our fee structure in place, and it obviously needs to be reviewed. We've gone through that a couple of times and presented the needs and the complexity of how, you know, we don't make money on it. We're providing the service at the cost for the service, but it also does include, as I spoke earlier, to our core services and maintaining the infrastructure for those services to be provided.
Okay. Other questions for Mrs. Cameron?
Real quick, Mr. Chair, and Patricia, don't we also do outside private background checks and charge for those?
Representative Cameron, members of the committee, yes.
That'd be a source of revenue that helps.
There, in the packet that we provided in November, also there is the Oregon law that allows for non-state agencies, non-regulated folks. There are a number of different services that Oregon has provided to the citizens in terms of background checks. Some are names, some are fingerprints. So there, hopefully we were able to answer that information. I can provide that again anytime.
Thank you. Other questions? I appreciate that. I know there's also been some interest in adding a public member to the work group in terms of protecting the public's rights, and perhaps we'll endeavor to get that done as this bill potentially moves forward. I appreciate all the work. I know it is a tough issue, but I, like Representative Nathanson, think that there is potential for efficiencies here and wish that we could get those, whether it's to reduce the redundancy at the very least, if possible. So I'm hoping that we'll have another discussion on this ahead of the February session, perhaps offline. And I guess that means next week. So with that, no other questions, I'm going to close the public hearing on LC 280. Next, I'd like to open a public hearing on LC 170. And do I turn to Patrick Sheehan or to Jan? Who would like to do the opening? Jan, please.
Well, Mr. Chair's committee members, LC 170 was a draft request made by Representative Sheehan. It requires the Office of Emergency Management to distribute 911 tax revenues directly to the 911 jurisdictions, and it declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
And my sign-up sheet for that, Representative Sheehan. Could you introduce yourself for the record, please, and provide us your thoughts on this LC?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Patrick Sheehan, and I represent House District 51. Legislative Concept 170 may now be referred to as House Bill 4051. Oregon has a 911 tax. You pay 75 cents a month on your landline and on your mobile phone, and that goes to pay for 911 to pick up the call when you have an emergency. This tax is collected on your phone bill, and it goes to the Office of Emergency Management, who allocates the funds to 246 cities and counties based on a per capita equation that does not change in any way with this bill. The cities and counties are required to send this money to their 911 centers either by writing another check or by asking Office of Emergency Management to just do that directly. All this bill does is it takes away the middleman by having every distribution go directly to the 911 centers from Office of Emergency Management. So this is the perfect bill for a very short legislative session because it creates a modest efficiency that's already been proven to work. In fact, two-thirds of the cities and counties do it this way voluntarily. It creates greater transparency by making reporting consistent and has overwhelming support from public safety interests. In fact, earlier today I got the very last signature of the very last legislator who has a public safety background on this bill. So every legislator with public safety background has signed on to this. Also in front of you are a few letters, including one from my sheriff in Clackamas County and a couple of other letters in support that will be talked about just a little bit later. An email from Gary Blackburn from the Secretary of State's office. There are 246 entities which are eligible to receive these payments, and all but 79 elect to have the fund distributed directly every quarter, which is what we're proposing, that they all have it distributed every quarter. Not only will this bill save us money in streamlining government payments for public safety, it will prevent confusion. And I want to quote a letter from Shannon Marine, who was then Director of Technology and Response for Office of Emergency Management back in December of 2010. As she said, looking over these budget reports, the analyst was finding some suspected deficiencies as to the proper budgeting of 911 excise tax as required under local budget law. She went on to say, as Oregon Office of Emergency Management is responsible for reporting to the legislature for the expenditure of the 911 excise tax, it is very important that the proper budgeting of the tax is followed and that the results are transparent. For further details, I'd like to bring up some other testimony, and I'll conclude my comments there and welcome any questions.
Any questions for Representative Sheehan? Representative Smith.
What's the downside? Might not be any, but what
I don't. I don't see one. I think the League of Oregon Cities is opposing the bill, and I haven't heard of anyone else.
Okay. Feel free to respond to this, but it's something on my mind. As cities have been on my mind, I toured in New York City and in D.C. their 311 system, and so what I actually considered putting in a bill this for the short session on exploring or moving towards a 311 system for all non-emergency government phone calls, but it seemed like different from what you characterized yours as a modest move. This would have not been a modest move, so I set it aside. I am hoping to have ongoing conversations. If we do this shift, does it have any impact on thinking about how we might have, common collection for other for non-emergency phone calls?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, absolutely not. In fact, the 911 call center in my area that I've toured handles those non-emergency calls. Mm-hmm. It's not with the 311 system, I don't believe, but there are people here that can answer that.
Right.
But no, this doesn't change any funding allocation or anything like that. All it does is it just takes out that middle part of this and makes it so that everybody reports the exact same number in the same way so that we can make decisions based on good data, which I know you like.
Thanks, Mr.
Thank you, and I'd like to change up the order of the witness registration and call up John Powell, Bessina Squires, and Ryan Harry. Hopefully I said all that right.
It's interesting, but I was on my tour out there. The fire chief said it probably up to 200 evacuations a day. Over 150 of them.
John C. Powell, excuse me.
To the fire department.
Whoever would like to go first.
Good afternoon, co-chairs Wisnett and Holvey, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Hasina Squires. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon APCONINA, which is the organization that represents the 911 centers in the state of Oregon. Also, I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon in support of this legislative concept. As Representative Sheehan summarized, the 911 tax is distributed to cities and counties. Special districts do not get a portion of that distribution. I want to be clear about that. The distribution does go to cities and counties on a per capita basis with a 1% minimum that goes to counties. Those funds are then, it is at the discretion of the city or the county to choose to have the funds sent directly to the 911 center or to pass them through as they are required to in statute to fund 911 services. So we see this bill as a regulatory streamlining bill. Why cut more checks than you need to cut? Why have auditors auditing more things that multiple places? The money comes to the clients that I represent, the 911 centers ultimately. This would just cut out the middleman and have the money sent directly there. And we would obviously be using it for only 911 purposes because that's all we do.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ryan Harry. I work for Clackamas Fire District, which is a special district near Portland, Oregon. We are the second largest fire district in the state and the largest in Clackamas County. We support LC-170. It's got broad-based support from fire, police, and dispatch agencies across the state. It simply streamlines the process of getting the 911 excise fees directly to the PSAPs. Currently, some of the excise funds go through cities and counties, and we're just eliminating that with this process. It eliminates multiple agencies and people in moving the 911 excuse me, excise funds directly to the PSAPs, saving red tape and unnecessary auditing. Ultimately, the citizens expect government to be responsible, transparent, efficient, and accountable. LC-170 ensures exactly that. Thank you very much for your support.
Co-Chairs Wisnett, Co-Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is John C. Powell, representing AT&T, and here to testify in support of the policy concepts behind LC-170. Since 1981, telecommunication companies such as AT&T have partnered with the state of Oregon, public safety generally, and our 46 PSAPs specifically to help fund the 911 system. Telecommunications companies act as the tax collector for the 911 fund. This is done by charging on each telecommunications bill a 75-cent fee every month. And on that bill that comes on, for instance, AT&T's letterhead, we put a line item in there that specifically says that this amount of your bill is going to fund our 911 system. And so the reason we're testifying today in support of this policy is that it is it more directly transfers the funds from our customers who pay the tax to the 911 system in an effective, efficient, and transparent way. So we urge your support in passage of this measure. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sina, this question's for you. Would this make it tougher for the cities and the legislature to sweep funds from the 911 fund like we did a few years back?
Co-Chairs Holby and Wisnett, no, it will not. I wish there was something in this legislation to do that. The only way that you would be able to prevent yourselves as a body from sweeping the 911 funds would be to lock those funds in the Oregon Constitution and require a constitutional vote to sweep them.
Any other questions? Sam Matthews.
I had a question, just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
I just want to thank Chief for being here, Chief Harvey. Appreciate all the work your organization does, along with us at Gresham Fire. Yep. And we rely heavily on each other for mutual aid, and you just have a great reputation out there. You do great work, and thanks for spending time. I know we took a while to get to you today, and I know you're busy, but thanks for being here today for your testimony, and thank all for the panel. Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, I will reiterate thank you for being patient and waiting, and thank you for participating.
Thank you.
Next up, I'd like Mike Caldwell.
Mr. Chairman, co-chairs, excuse me, and members of the committee, the stack that I brought up here was designed as a prop. It's I'll just let you stare at that for a second. But presently, the
and could Oregon, you introduce yourself, because Representative Widener is new to this committee and may not have seen you before.
I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of Oregon Military Department and the Interim Director of the Office of Emergency Management.
Thank you and welcome.
Thank you for being here. We presently, our position on this concept is essentially neutral, but we're pro in the direction that this is going with respect to the language. And that's the reason for this. This is the accounting for 276 accounts that we have to maintain. I've also provided you with another sheet of paper that shows you only 70, and these are the lowest 70 under $1,000 that we cut checks to. If I was king, I would probably turn it around and say we're going to have 36 checks and send 36 of them out to the counties and let you guys sort it out. Probably not doable under this. So anything that reduces the workload, now again, not all of them get a check because they've made agreements under the law right now that currently allows them to make those agreements so we can send one check, but some of them haven't. Out of the 49 PSAPs that are in the state of Oregon, 18 are run by cities, 12 are run by counties, 12 are run by councils of government, 5 are run by special districts that have been formed, 1 is a county service district, which is another form of that, and 1 is tribal. The tribal in Warm Springs does not receive any 911 funds. However, Jefferson County does give some of their funds to them, as I understand it, which is allowable under the law, but it's not required that we would give the tribal. So I think anything you can do as a legislative body, it's not going to save us a ton of money, but it's probably going to be somewhere on the order of $10,000 to $20,000 a biennium, somewhere in that range that we're going to save for just not having to send checks out. So I would say in that regard, we're pro to move this thing along in one form or another. But you can take it to 36 and I'd be happier. And there is one way you could keep from sweeping the funds. Just don't ever come back to Salem, see, so.
That concludes my testimony. There's people working on that now, General.
I don't know if you totally appreciate that, though, at some
point. No, we need to, believe it or not.
Thank you very much. Any questions for General Caldwell?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, General. I got with General Reese and Turner before this hearing. And
yes, sir. I just got a phone call a little bit ago about that.
It's going really well out there. They're working really great together, and it's good to see everybody working together. Question on this issue. You said maybe $20,000 on check and administration. How about the auditing and those types of things? Is there any kind of number you can put around it?
Co-chairs and Representative Cameron, I'm not prepared to give you a number on that. I know that any as we send the money out to the local government, they have to do an audit by law, so it's always done. They turn it into Secretary of State, so that's borne by the local government. We, of course, have audits by Sec State as well, and we pay for those, and I doubt that it would make a significant difference in there because they're auditing anyway. So it's probably a small wedge in that. It takes time, obviously, but I don't know how you'd put exact hours to it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just add to that and answer a bit of that question, a lot of the research that we did on this bill were specific questions that have been asked and brought up and audits triggered as a result of some of these, the different practices of accounting and figuring out where this is going, whether it hits that PSAP directly or it gets filtered through. So I've got several pieces here that have been direct questions that have triggered audits.
Mr. Chairman, I might just add one other thing. Budget note from this body, our budget had us report in February with a complete review of the 911 system in Oregon. We contracted for that. The report should be done at the end of the month. And it's basically there's an inclination on the Ways and Means Committee that, or a belief that the present system is too expensive, redundant, too many PSAPs. We'll have that report. You can look at that in, I think, in the whole 911 scope, and there'll be some options for you to examine. On top of that, in 2013, the authorization of the 911 statute it will sunset, so it needs to be redone. So I would say for about the next 2 years, I'm going to say we're going to be fairly busy working with this body to make some changes. So what they are, I can't forecast what they'll be. I think that'll be a menu that you'll get to choose from, and I'm sure that the folks that directly affects this will definitely have a good deal of input, which they should have, that it impacts them. So lots of opportunity to deal with 911 issues in the next 2 years.
So did you say that would be available at the end of this month, January?
Yes, sir. We will have it available because we need to report to the Ways and Means Committee. So
you could also see that our committee administrator gets a
we'll be happy to do that.
She can probably track it down, but it might be useful to.
It'll probably be a fairly popular item in this building.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. You.
Appreciate it.
And again, thank you for your patience in waiting for this. Next up, Scott Winkles and Eric Schmidt. Welcome, good afternoon, and if you'd state your name for the record, please.
Certainly. For the record, I'm Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities. I'm the League's public safety lobbyist, among other things. Before I begin, some of my colleagues alluded to it. the continued sweep of funds, 911 funds, by the legislature. I would like to point out to the committee that early in February, the FCC issued their third annual report on distribution of 911 funds, and Oregon has gone 3 for 3 noted federally for sweeping those funds. As a result, Oregon is not currently eligible to receive grants from the FCC for 911 improvements, so it is something we pay a consequence for. Sorry, I can get that on the record whenever I can.
Thank you. So noted.
So I would like to point out a couple of things. We do have some concerns about moving this LC forward in the February session. First off, as has been pointed out earlier, it is permissive for local governments to ask for a direct payment right now. I've also, and many are doing so. I've also been in contact with members of OEM staff. You might imagine they're a little busy right now, and the conversations have been brief. But what I have heard from the administrators of the program is that LC-170 would confuse issues, and that they believe that there are other methods in moving forward that would be, in their words, better. What I would respectfully suggest is that on the Senate side, there is a robust work group taking place right now that Senator Olson is putting forward. It has all the 911 stakeholders at the table, the subscribers, the PSAPs, cities, counties, public safety, the end users in place. The intention is to bring forward comprehensive 911 legislation of 2013. This would be an opportunity to have all interested parties in the room vet concerns with the current distribution systems and come forward with a truly consensus bill. Is our current 911 financing system more complicated than it needs to be? It probably is. Does this make it better? I don't think we've had the conversations that where we know that for certain. In a conversation yesterday in a fire services meeting, I heard one fire chief complain that there is the fire service doesn't get enough benefit from the current 911 system, and this might improve it. I think we should move forward on might. I think we should move forward on certainties. And the last thing I would say is that during these conversations, we've heard some comments about recipients, now subscriber agencies, misappropriating these funds, even inadvertently. When we've tracked these down, it appears that they've received clean bills of most of the cities that I've heard mentioned have received clean bills of health in their annual third-party audits. If there is a specific allegation to move against a specific city, I think that should trigger a Secretary of State audit, and we can find out conclusively what's going on. It'd be very difficult for a city to actually misappropriate these funds, and I'll tell you why. We'll take the city of Estacada as an example. They receive $11,000 in 911 funds to pay for their 911 services, but their total bill is actually closer to $29,000. So they're making up the rest. To misappropriate that $11,000 to $12,000 they receive from the state would just mean they'd have to make up for that in their general fund. So there's not a strong and final financial incentive for a city to do that, and that sort of misappropriation would be very difficult to conceal in an audit. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnant, Representative Sheehan, thank you for working with us on this issue. Members of the committee, I'm Eric Schmidt. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'd just like to echo what Scott said about the 911 sweeps and the effect that it has on FCC grants. As far as LC-170 is concerned, I'm here to tell you that the Association of Oregon Counties does not have a position on this particular piece of legislation yet. We are meeting on January the 23rd, next Monday, with our legislative committee, and we're looking forward to a robust discussion among our members about this concept. There are some concerns among county administrators and some county commissioners about the concept of the bill, but we hope to have that resolved and get back and work with the committee on this bill after that. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Matthews.
I don't mean to oversimplify this, but I'm just trying to get my head around it. So if the check that's being cut to a city is the same as the check they're cutting to the 911 provider, why wouldn't it make sense to remove the regulatory, you know, the phase of that and just get it so that we can minimize that process and just send that money straight from one to the other without going through the city? I don't understand what the point of that is. And to your point about how difficult it would be through the process of accounting, I can say that I think it's fairly easy to misappropriate or to reappropriate funds or redirect funds using police and fire as your catalyst to raise more money through revenue and levies. So I'm not accusing anybody of that. I'm just saying, being on the other side of that fence, looking at the limited amount of revenues available, I think there is a way to redirect funds towards parks and other things that wouldn't necessarily be a compelling vote for a voter. So with that being said, my real question is, what's the angst here about, you know, just eliminating the regulatory statute here or the regulation process?
Co-Chair Holby, Co-Chair Wisnett, Representative Matthews, you're in a highly consolidated 911 environment where you're probably getting services from BOAC and CECOM.
Correct.
To serve in your area.
Just BOAC.
Downstate, you're in a different scenario. So as to General Caldwell's point about consolidations earlier, because of the timing of when these bills come out and the city doesn't necessarily give their check at the same time as the state cuts their check, I think we could, and I'm not saying we are, I'm saying we should work this out, vet this and talk about it. We could create a further obstacle for entities that do want to consolidate. I mean, oftentimes the league has been portrayed as a no consolidation. That isn't our position at all. We have members who actively are pursuing consolidation of 911. All we are simply saying is that we do not inadvertently impact the effort to consolidate a 911 center by the system. And when I hear that the agency responsible for administering this program says it will add confusion, that is the sort of thing that's going to perk my ears up a little bit. If I've answered your question, yeah, that makes sense.
Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that. That's helpful. And if you're interested in talking about consolidations when it comes to public safety, I'm more than happy to engage in that conversation with different administrations and three chiefs in one small area serving the same community. It doesn't really make sense. We can put more people on the street, but we can talk about that some other day.
I look forward to that, Representative.
Other questions? I thought this one was going to be boring.
Sheehan. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked about the permissive nature of the bill as it stands, and that people are actually doing that. And I've seen all of the letters that have gone out from the Office of Emergency Management with warnings about how to spend this correctly, and the Secretary of State audits areas sending out letters and how to spend it correctly. How many of those have been to the cities and counties that have decided to go with the direct payment versus the ones that have filtered? Are you aware of any that have come through as a direct payment that have been the subject of scrutiny, I guess is my question.
Co-Chair Holby, Co-Chair Wisnett, Representative Sheehan, I haven't perused that data. I don't know.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen. I appreciate that. Interesting topic. Got my attention. So with that, I think I'll close the public hearing on LC 170. And I believe we're ready for a work session. Are we not, Committee Administrator Jan Nordland?
We've had all of the hearings. That's
correct. Okay.
Oh.
Got to do the bills. Got to move the bills.
We're going to do the work session now.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So I will open a work session for the purpose of introducing committee legislative concepts. And if I could have a motion on the four committee concepts, and then we'll describe a couple of those concepts that we haven't talked about.
Mr. Co-Chair, I would also ask that we remind the committee members that your vote yes to move these as committee bills does not commit you to vote for these bills. We're just asking you to vote to move the bills forward. You still have the right to not vote or support the bills.
Yeah, yes, I appreciate that. The vote is just a vote to allow the introduction of these committee concepts. Does not indicate your support or favor of any individual concept. That's determined later. It just allows us to have the discussion.
Co-Chair Hovey, I move LC Draft 207 as a committee bill, to introduce as a committee bill.
I think you wanted to have it in
block. All of them?
Yeah, just list them all. Do we have the dates on those?
I don't.
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Co-Chair, I move LC Draft 221. Dated January 10, 2012, LC Draft 257, dated January the 6th, 2012, LC Draft 207, dated December 9th, 2011, LC Draft 208, dated December 21st, 2011. Be introduced as committee bills.
Representative Wisnett has moved to adopt LC Draft 207, dated December 9th, 2011, LC 208, dated December 21st, 2011, LC 221, dated January 10th, 2012, and LC 257, dated January 6th, 2012, to be adopted as committee bills. Discussion. The committee, the two bills that we haven't discussed today, LC 207, 208, were both bills that passed out of this committee last session. I do know that LC 208 will be having an amendment to put a cap on the fees out of the contracting price, and a sunset on that particular bill. So we'll be seeing that if this bill were to move forward to a public hearing. So with that, and LC 207 relating to the vacant positions in state agencies, a bill that I'm sure any of you that were on this committee last session remember quite clearly, was a bill that Representative Wisnett and I disagreed on, and then worked on it together to come up with a bill we thought was good. Both these bills died in the Ways and Means process, and it's my intention to see them back down there to reconsider those bills. So with that, the motion has been made. Any other discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to adopting these as legislative concepts? And with that, the concepts previously stated will be adopted as committee concepts and turned in by our committee administrator to become bills. Thank you. Any other items of business from the committee?
Were you taking your wife to dinner?
That remains to be seen.
Can I join you, Mr. Chair?
Excuse me?
Did he ask, is he taking his Widener to dinner?
I'm going to miss the two of you.
No. with that, I will close the work session and adjourn the House Interim Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection.